lodged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent desecration of Islam's holy book. Protesters came from across the UK in order to make their upset clear and to pressure European governments to take anti-Muslim hate more seriously.
This is the latest example of a protest to take place as anger across the Muslim world remains incredibly high. This week alone, there have been numerous Quran-burning protests and promises by right-wing activists to continue the pressure. As the protests continue, the anger will continue to grow too.
Activists informed Press TV how their love for the Quran compelled them to act.
We live for Quran. The Quran is very respectful. The Holy Quran is not our word, not our book. It's the book from Allah, then has to be very respectful.
This should stop because this is our human right, as well as the European laws, as we are living in European continent. The European law states that every religion and their religious leadership must be respected.
On Monday, a Dutch politician tore apart a copy of the Holy Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed an incident in Sweden where a politician burned a copy of the Quran outside the Turkish embassy. These extremists have been receiving authorities' permission to conduct the heinous acts, even provided police protection under the guise of freedom of expression. Mosques, Muslim strong residential areas, and embassies belonging to Muslim countries have all been the target of these Islamophobic incidents. This blatant state facilitation of anti-Islam extremism has led many Muslims to feel vulnerable in a continent which claims to defend minority and religious rights. Robert Carter, London.
Geomatics is not a well-known term amongst the public, but it's actually the driving force behind many of the daily activities in man's modern life. The second Iran Geo Exhibition offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in the field.
Geo means earth, and geomatics is a science and technology that deal with the collection, distribution and analysis of geographic data using aerial and satellite imaging. To put it simply, when you take an online cab, you're using a geomatic technology known as GPS, which is short for Global Positioning System.
Geomatics has its traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, archaeological excavation, climate change and environmental monitoring, disaster risk reduction, and estimation of crop yields. Over the past decade, an increasing number of tech firms in Iran have expressed interest in geomatics.
We develop aerial imaging and surveying technologies. We also offer geophysical services. Here in this expo, we're showcasing our imaging and surveying drones, which can draw maps and collect topographical data to facilitate mining operations.
As the organizer of the tech event, the Iranian Defense Ministry says it is planning to encourage more companies to operate in geomatics to turn the strategic field into a viable source of income for the country.
The world is shifting toward new and strategic technologies. Our country, too, is treading on the same path. Geomatics and its associated technologies have numerous applications. They are a major factor in advancing our space program. So, we invited major brands to this expo to help us achieve our goals by advancing geomatics in our country.
Organizers say during the 4 days of the second geomatics exhibition, B2B meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. The event will also hold workshops for startups to acquaint them with the needs of the market.
Without geomatics, many businesses, such as online ride-sharing services, would not exist. Experts here say the range of applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investment to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis are urging their government to take decisive action to end the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen. before the month of Ramadan begins. Due to Saudi Arabia's strangling blockade, food, fuel, and gas prices increased drastically during the holy month. Here at the Al Sanaa market, where many Yemenis do their shopping, customers said they want their government to adopt measures that will resuscitate Yemen's economy and end the continuous price hikes.
The strangling blockade is why food prices are increasing. When prices increase, it makes life harder for business owners.
We ask our government to improve our ballistic missile capability because it is our missile capability that will break the siege.
According to Mohammed Miftah, who is an advisor to the president of Yemen's Salvation Government, the cabinet's main task is to keep Yemen's battered economy afloat in the midst of a brutal war.
The government's main task, given the current circumstances, is to provide essential services like electricity, water, and building roads so people can travel. It's true, prices remain high. However, in the near future, the government aims to provide services at a lower price. In general, the main cause of the surge in prices is the Saudi blockade.
Mohammed Miftah says, despite the surge in prices, the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen's economy is leading to nowhere.
The enemy was hoping to strangle Yemen's economy completely by preventing all fuel and gas from entering Yemen. We have successfully foiled this plan, and now fuel and gas are available, even though they're slightly overpriced. The important thing is that they're available, which is more important.
For the time being, the Yemeni government shows a willingness to engage in peaceful political dialogue to end the war. However, much of the public has lost hope in the peace process.
Yemeni people are calling on the Salvation Government to break Saudi Arabia's siege on the country before the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a has called on Riyadh to lift the blockade multiple times. The kingdom has so far refused the requests, which means Yemen's next option could be a military one. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The memory of the rape and murder of pedestrian Sarah Everard in 2020 by then Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins is seared on everybody's mind here. The police commissioner at the time, Cressida Dick, called it a case of a few bad apples in the force and promised action to weed them out. She was soon forced to resign, leaving a police force in crisis. The latest scandal to rock the mat, David Carrick, an officer from the same unit as Wayne Cousins, pleading guilty to tens of offenses, including rape against 12 women over nearly two decades. The response from the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, an apology and the promise of a cleanup. Yet critics of the Metropolitan Police Force say they don't think that will solve the problem.
I think the proposition that it's just a few bad apples has been blown completely out the water. What we have in reality is a deeply systemized culture of misogyny and racism that speaks and exists at the very heart, the core of the Metropolitan Police Service. It is beyond reform. It is beyond saving.
The Force Commissioner Rowley Commands was placed under special measures last year after revelations of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny among some of its officers against people inside and outside the force. New anonymous revelations from serving police officers speak of a culture of racism and sexual abuse in the force, which has left some black staff suicidal.
The issue is that systematized culture actually targets and alienates black and ethnic minority officers. And that has a profound impact upon their family life, their mental health, their physical health. And we've seen examples, haven't we, time and time again, of black officers suffering life-changing, transforming trauma as a consequence of facing racism in the Met.
These are dark days for Britain's largest police force, with confidence in policing already at an all-time low. And the recent admission by one of its own will worsen trust in the people who are supposed to be protecting society. Cyper is up, London.
Music. Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kiev and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP-T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP-T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, tempers are running high in Pakistan over the repeated Islamophobic incidents by some European countries in recent days. Outraged Pakistanis took to the streets of the capital Islamabad after Friday prayers to condemn the West for what they call its malicious anti-Islamic agenda.
Burning of Muslims' holy book by these Western nations proved that Islamophobic acts were not an expression of freedom of speech, but extremism. Sadly, extremism exists and is growing everywhere in Europe. It's time for European nations to think about who's promoting extremism by desecrating other religions.
Protesters chanted slogans and vented their anger against the silence of the West regarding repeated incidents of desecration of Holy Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. Demonstrators also called on Muslim nations to boycott European goods over what they describe as the West's insolent behavior.
We strongly condemn the blasphemous incident of desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. The incident is the worst and most heartbreaking act in Europe. There is no room for such a sad incident in a civilized society.
Demonstrators are demanding that the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, known as OIC, raise its voice against the growing intolerance against Islam and anti-Muslim acts across the globe.
It's time for the OIC to play its role in urging Muslim nations to stand united against Western conspiracies. Europe wants to ignite Muslims by doing such blasphemous acts. Once we are united, Europe will not dare to repeat such Islamophobic acts.
The countrywide rallies came days after Pakistan denounced what it described as the abhorrent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden and the Netherlands, saying such acts disrespect Muslims across the globe.
Condemnations continue to pour in from Muslim countries across the world. Yemen, Qatar, along with other Islamic nations, joined Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey to denounce the desecration. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
People of Afghanistan are extremely upset about the deplorable and shocking act of some extremist individuals in Sweden and Holland in desecrating the Holy Quran, which is taken as a disrespect towards not just the Holy Book of Muslims, but all holy scriptures, by tearing the Holy Quran and setting it on fire. The primitive and uncivilized act of a bunch of radical elements in Europe has raised robust condemnation from Afghan people against such abominable act.
They claim human rights and still burn the Holy Quran. It looks like it's only for themselves. We want the Swedish government to punish the perpetrator of this action, and also ask Islamic countries to be united against this action.
Even when such people insult the Holy Quran, the book's value increases for us. If we are not burning their holy books in response today, it is because of the teaching of the Holy Quran to have a peaceful relation with all people.
The Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has also condemned the awful action and called for punishment of its perpetrators in Sweden and Holland.
We ask the government of Sweden to punish the perpetrators of this crime and do not let such individuals to act in provocative and heinous ways against the holy books.
The Holy Quran is simply a fundamental element to unite Muslims, so that Afghan politicians from various groups and ethnicities, including former administrators and current statesmen at the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, break ranks with the disgusting radical act towards the Holy Book committed by some extremist groups in Europe, and roundly condemn the disgusting act under the guise of freedom of speech. The Afghan politicians unanimously announced that the spirit and essence of coexistence of ideas and thoughts is definitely on the line, then on.
During the protest, people of Afghanistan have called for the unity among believers of all Ibrahimic religions towards such targeted attacks, which have mainly aimed at weakening believing souls and freedom seekers of the entire world, and not just Islam and Muslims. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. British media have reported that 3 out of 7 tenants in England have seen their rent increases in the past few weeks or months. Also, the increasing trend of interbank interest rates in England, which is directly related to mortgage payments of millions of British households, means that the country is now facing a serious housing crisis. We'll take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website moneyweek.com has covered the story and tells us more. A leading British property company has reported the average monthly rent across Britain, excluding London, has hit a new record of £1,172 per month, as people are struggling to cope with the surging inflation and worsening cost of living crisis. Rightmove, a UK-based real estate company, said on its website on Friday 27th of January that tenants in London are being asked to fork out over twice that amount, with a typical private rent hitting as high as £2,480, a 5.8% increase from the previous quarter. James Reddington, sales and letting director at Douglas & Gordon, was at pains to say that. "We've seen the highest rent increases we've seen for decades, and we don't expect this to slow down in the short term." The website also warned of the rising gap between demand and supply, noting that more homes are getting available for rent as tenants cannot afford
the renting costs. Right Move said the number of available homes to rent in December of 2022 had increased by 13% compared with a year earlier, predicting that the average number of people asking for rents across Britain will rise by 5% in 2023, unless there is a significant addition of available homes to rent. The average asking rent had already experienced a 7% rise in December of 2022. Rightmove's Director of Property Science, Tim Bannister, said, "Although the fierce competition among tenants to find a home is starting to ease, it is still double the level it was back in 2019. Tim Bannister added, "Letting agents are seeing extremely high volumes of tenant inquiries and dealing with tens of potential tenants for each available property. The simmering renting costs are not the only implication of the deteriorating economic situation across the United Kingdom. Energy and food prices, along with vital living costs, have experienced a sharp increase in recent months, as the United Kingdom is grappling with its decades-high inflation. Due to the worsening cost of living crisis and low wages, the labour forces in different industries have staged strikes across the country, paralysing the country's vital infrastructure such as rail services and the healthcare system." British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Wales and southwest of England have seen the biggest jumps in new properties to rent, which used asking rents of properties listed on Rightmove to make the findings. Rightmove's Director of Property Science, Tim Bannister, said landlords will need to balance any rent rises with what tenants can afford to pay in their local area to continue to find tenants quickly and avoid any periods where their home is empty due to tenants not being able to meet the asking rent. He said, "There appears to be some more property choice for renters compared to the record low levels of last year, which would slightly ease the fierce competition to secure a home." Tim Bannister added, "This is why we're forecasting that the pace of annual growth will ease to around 5% by the end of the year nationally, although this would still significantly exceed the average of 2% that we saw during the 5 years before the pandemic." Simon Lee, director at Hackney & Lee Estate Agents and Letting Agents, said, "The rental market remains buoyant and the majority of our landlords are still receiving multiple applications on their properties." Simon Lee added, "Rents have remained stable due in part to the cautious approach from landlords when considering rent increases at renewal stage, preferring to retain good tenants rather than have even a small void period or incur the associated costs." According to a think tank, more than 2 in 5 or 44% working age households reported being either behind on or struggling with housing-related costs in November. According to the Resolution Foundation's figures, the proportion of those who have fallen behind or are struggling has jumped from 26% during the depths of the coronavirus pandemic in January of 2021. The latest survey found that while 6% of working-age households had fallen behind on their housing costs in November last year, a further 38% had met their costs but had struggled. The Foundation suggested that while the COVID-19 crisis worsened housing stress, the current cost of living crisis has delivered a more extensive shock to British households. Researchers found 8% of private renters reported falling behind on housing costs in the 3 months leading up to November of 2022. Nearly a fifth, or 19%, of social renters reported falling behind with their housing costs, as did 4% of mortgage holders. Some of those surveyed owed their home outright. Many mortgage holders have not felt the immediate impacts of interest rates rising due to being on a fixed rate mortgage deal, but they could see their costs increase when their current deal comes to an end. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has also covered the same story and tells us more. A former Bank of England bigwig warned of more pain to come for millions of British households from rising mortgage costs. Andy Haldane, who was the Bank of England's chief economist until 2021, predicted real wages would fall again this year because of the impact of punishingly high inflation. The Bank of England is forecast to hike its main interest rate from 3.5% to 4% next week to try to cool inflation. That will hit millions of borrowers with variable rate mortgages and those looking for new home loans. But Andy Haldane, now chief executive of the Royal Society of Art, said, "It is painful and I fear there is more pain to come as those mortgage rate rises for the last year begin to hit people's bank accounts over this year." High Street Bank TSB recently announced it was setting aside £55 million for loans that might turn sour because of the worsening economy and the cost of living crisis. But the lender said it had yet to see a marked increase in customers experiencing financial difficulties or missing payments. Boss Robin Bullock said, "The resilience of customers is quite remarkable." Andy Haldane, interviewed on BBC Radio 4's Today programme, said, "The terrible double whammy of first COVID and then the cost of living crisis has and is causing huge amounts of financial stress for many businesses, for many households and, of course, for many charities." He added, "We've had a lost decade and a half in terms of pay rises in inflation-adjusted terms. Last year, we saw real pay fall, and we are most likely to see that same happen again this year, and that is putting acute financial stress and indeed mental stress on great many British households."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Five Memphis police officers pummel a black man with kicks, punches, and baton blows over a traffic stop violation that was alleged. Days later, the man dies in the hospital. An all-too-familiar scene in the U.S. which is plagued by police violence. This time, though, five officers were also black. In the meantime, Americans held rallies in different cities and towns, including in Memphis, to protest the police heavy-handed tactics. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how police violence in the U.S. continues to claim lives, and why police brutality appears enshrined in the police's conduct in the U.S. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Wilma Leon, political analyst, joins us from Washington, D.C. And Frank Emspach, Workers Independent News, joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines.
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Wilmer Leon, I'll first start with you, and I'm sorry, but I want to recount the death scene with you based on this unfortunate man, Nichols, who was pulled out of the car. Have you seen the video, by the way, Wilmer Leon?
Yes, I have.
I know it's very rough, but again, I have a purpose behind asking you and relaying this again or recounting this scene again. Nichols pulled out of the car for an alleged traffic stop, pushed to the ground, and then he was beaten and pepper sprayed multiple times. And then later on, we saw the scene in the hospital of which he died then, I guess a few days later. And the reason for his death was deemed to be extensive bleeding caused by a severe beating. I need to get your reaction on this and as to how you saw the way that the police went ahead with the violence that they executed on this young man. And as to why you think they went at it the way they did.
Well, I think I can start with the latter part of the question first. They went at it in the manner in which they did because they brought a certain perspective, a certain approach, a certain mindset to the scene in the first place. This Scorpion team, as they're called, supposedly responsible for targeting crime in a particular area, and particularly felony types of crimes. And in many neighborhoods, they're called jump out squads. And what tends to happen is a groupthink, is a dog pack mentality, and that's what you saw exhibited on the video that you witnessed, because they brought the escalation to the scene. There was nothing that Tyree Nichols did that A, warranted the traffic stop in the first place, and then B, once the traffic stop was being executed, there was nothing that he did that would have caused an escalation to the level of violence that we saw. The level of violence basically began as soon as this traffic stop began. So that tells me that they had a particular predilection. They had a particular predisposition to engage in this behavior. And one of the reasons I believe that they do this in this manner is to send a message to others in the community that this is our neighborhood, these are our streets, you are under our occupation, and we don't care what you say, how you think, how you feel, what you do. We run these streets, and you are basically subservient to us. That's the message that groups of these types, that's the message that Chauvin was sending in his approach to George Floyd. It had less to do with George Floyd and more to do with sending a message to those bystanders of who's in control of the situation.
Well, that's a pretty heavy point. Do you agree with the point that's made there by our guest, Frank Emsbach?
Yes, I do. I think it goes that these teams are trained to be super aggressive. They're trained to be very cohesive. They're trained to support each other. And so this kind of activity is what's going to happen. I think that what we've got, you know, throughout the United States in many, many cities are these SWAT teams and whatnot. This is 25, 30 years old. And it's fundamentally useless in terms of dealing with crime, but it's just crazy when it comes to traffic stops. We're talking about crime, so-called, that might at the most result in a ticket, not capital punishment. And so you have a system set up to have people who can kill people for a, you know, broken taillight or because a person's going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. And so this is not some minor thing. In the United States in the last year, in 2022, police killed 1,096 people. That's a lot of people. Not all of them were traffic stops, obviously, but, you know, 1,000 people. That's a lot of people.
That figure I have as 1,176, depending on what source you have. Mapping police violence is what I have as. Go ahead.
Yeah, 1,001. I have the mapping police violence number, and the number I have in 2022 is 1,185. So, you know, we're within the margin of error of the survey.
Oh, okay. Well, the reason why I said that even is because every human life counts. Now, obviously, it makes it the deadliest year on record for 2022. And to go along with that stat of what I have compiled here, it's interesting how the characterization then is placed on the U.S. police when this stat is mentioned based on this one particular source, Wilmer Leon, where it says the U.S. police has killed more people compared to any other industrialized democracy, with a disproportionate number of people shot, and those are people of color. It's an interesting description there. What do you think of it?
Well, look, you have a whole system in this country of...
I'll come to you, Wilmer Leon. Frank M. Speck, go ahead.
We have a whole thing in this country of racism. I mean, this is not anything to debate anymore. The only thing they didn't mention yesterday was driving while black, which in this town, Madison, Wisconsin, was a real issue, where you have a disproportionate number of black drivers on the street near our house here being arrested for traffic stops for basically nothing. And this happens, this is pervasive throughout our society. The 1,000 people killed or 1,100 people killed is a reflection, and the racial differentiation there is a reflection of a society that has had a system starting of slavery, you know, and for, 300 years. And so you're going to have all of those negative aspects, all of those things where people are treated not as human being, as part of a culture. And that culture is exacerbated and pushed when you put together people in a hyper-aggressive, small-unit police force.
The reaction now taken in terms of a particular response, Wilmer Leon, again, I need to ask you this, is that, and it's presented as a solution, I think, where they have deactivated the unit that these five officers worked in. Do you think that that is going to solve the problem?
Oh, not at all, because the problem is endemic in the zeitgeist of America. This is who America is. This is a domestic representation of what the United States does internationally. This is what you're seeing play out in American cities is what America did in Iraq. It's what America is trying to do in Iran. It's what America did in Afghanistan. It's what America did in Vietnam. It's what America did in Grenada. This is how America deals with its issues. If crime is the issue that's trying to be addressed, crime is a reflection of poverty. Crime is not something that is inherent in a particular culture, group of people, in a particular ethnicity. Crime is a reflection of poverty. So if you deal with crime, you don't generate squads, you deal with poverty. You raise people out of poverty. You don't send $70 billion to Ukraine, you send $70 billion to Madison, Wisconsin, to Memphis, Tennessee, to Oakland, California. You create jobs, you create a life in a culture that has meaning and value. You don't just impose more force upon a defenseless group of people.
Well, what has the U.S. government done here, Frank M. Speck? I think at Joe Biden's $30 billion funding, it included, unlike what our guests there said, included funding police officers on, and it called for the expansion of accountable community policing. Now, is that not a good amount, or is that not a good approach by Biden, and why has it not worked?
I don't, look, let's try this. Are somebody a criminal because they go out and they beat somebody on the head? Of course. The front page of the New York Times today, a drug company stole $144 billion by manipulating the patents on Humira drugs. Who's the criminal? Okay, so there's that whole aspect of what is criminality. In terms of policing, think about it. You're trying to stop, in theory, you know, people creating, you know, doing violent crimes or something. And you're going to do this by driving around the city and hopefully see something, maybe, and or if not, go arrest somebody who's driving. I mean, it makes no sense, and it doesn't work. Okay, that's the other part of this. But what works is community cohesion. And what works is, to an extent, is the proper people also being at the scene. One thing that could be done, even within the current framework, is for all kinds of domestic violence type calls and many, many others, you have trained mental health people, EMS type people, coming to the scene. For traffic stops, as they have done in some cities, you disarm the people who are involved in the traffic stops, the police, so that at least you're not going to get somebody killed. Okay, so there are things that can be done. I don't see any of that thinking in Biden's budget, but it's possible. There have been funding to try to have alternative routes to public intervention when you have something that you see, you know, like the domestic violence. And that may help. But the overall approach, if just putting money into the police worked, we'd be the safest country in the world because we put in more than anybody else consistently for the last 50 years. We have more people in jail than anybody else. So clearly, it isn't working.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Leon, can you please explain to us the defunding police call that's been made and why it is that calls are being made for that? What solution lies in that rather than funding the police or continuing to fund the police and maybe even fund it more? I'm trying to understand the voice from the two camps.
I wish that there were the term, I think, refunding the police, in my humble opinion, as a public policy person would make more sense. Defunding the police is a clever slogan, and it resonates well with a particular group of people. But as a policy, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because there's no clear definition in terms of what it means. I have interpreted this to mean, based upon a number of activists and people that I've spoken with, is that a lot of the resources that are going into police departments need to be redirected into better preventative measures so that you don't have things don't escalate to the point to where you need the police in the first place. There are also initiatives that are being generated that police forces need to be put into public safety organizations so that they work more cohesively with EMS, they work more cohesively with other elements in your government that deliver social services so that there's a cooperative effort instead of the police arriving on the scene as the be-all and end-all in a circumstance where mental health professionals may be needed as opposed to excessive force that unfortunately gets used by too many police officers. So again, defunding the police, it's a great slogan. It doesn't really have a definition. The definition varies depending on who you talk to. So I think a better explanation of it is refunding the police, directing those resources to places where public service and need would be better served.
Looking through the research material here, Frank M. Spack, one of the things that perhaps one reads and may skim over it, but then come back to it because it's rather important, and I'd like to find out from you if it is or not, is the question that was posed where it's asked, what is the biggest problem facing police in the USA today? Now, you would think that it would be police violence, but what this particular source said was that currently police recruitment and then retention, it says, is arguably the largest problem facing the criminal justice system, and then referred to police. Isn't that, in a sense, very alarming? And if it is true, because to retain the police, doesn't it mean that they may grant them more leniency when it comes to the way they conduct themselves?
It depends why the police are leaving the police force, I suppose. The discussion in Memphis was that the county board or whoever the appropriate authority was went after the police pensions, and so the police left. So in other cases, you know, it's true that sometimes the police forces do not want the kind of scrutiny that they're getting. And in the Chicago case, for instance, the police chief there left as well and wound up becoming police chief in a town of 5,000. As opposed to a town of 2 million. But in any event, every single social service in this country is facing a crisis of hiring and replacement and training. The police may be more so than others. The question of funding, though, is crucial. The defund the police gave the right wing, at least in this state, a club to beat everybody over the head with. They said, we can't defund the police. You guys who are saying that, you know, or believe in crime and so on and so forth. And it was, I think, an unnecessary opening. What we need is the kind of comprehensive discussion that our other guest was talking about, that you have all kinds of things that go on that don't need the police, you know, per se. Well, you have evictions, you have family disputes, you have traffic stops, which are the least effective of anything. You know, so you have to change this. You have to have the kind of society where you're teaching from the beginning that all people are human beings. You can't have this continuing sort of cultural norm where there's a sense that some people are inferior and some aren't. Because once that happens, then you're not hurting somebody who's like you. You're beating up some animal, which is exactly the language that some of these people use. Mm-hmm. So it's a much deeper thing here than just the police techniques. And it's one that really needs to be addressed from a social perspective, from a broader perspective than just the technique of traffic stops.
I find it very interesting that even after all these years, you're still looking at the fact that this discrimination and the issue of color resonates or is so boldly displayed when it comes to police violence. Wilmer Leon, where it says Black Americans are most likely to experience fatal police violence. And there was a 40-year study, 1980 through 2019, where they were estimated to be 3.5 times more likely to die from police violence than white Americans. Why are we looking at this kind of disparity? Why are we looking at Blacks being targeted that way? I don't know if I should use the word target, but they've been a victim, obviously, 3.5 times more than whites.
Because America is a racist country. It was founded on racism. Racism has been one of the elements that has fueled who America is, how America was built, and so it is inherent. Look at Ron DeSantis in Florida, and he doesn't even want African-American studies to be taught in AP advanced placement courses in high schools in Florida. They are so afraid. Many conservative, particularly white Americans, are so afraid of telling the truth about who America is and what America does that they don't want these things taught in schools. And the only way that we're ever going to be able to move to the point that where Frank was talking about is this has to be taught. And let me give, a really quick example of something that I noticed in the tape of the beating of Tyre Nichols. Five officers involved in the actual physical contact, probably another five or six officers standing on the periphery watching what was going on, not intervening, and even failing to render aid. Mess shows the scene. Now that's the fire department. They don't do anything either. So what that says to me is there's a mindset that that goes throughout the public service response apparatus within Memphis. It's not only limited to the police department. It has made its way into the fire department and into the ambulance service as well.
All right. So we just have about a minute left here. Frank Imsbach. I think we don't have Frank Imsbach with us. Frank, are you with us?
If you study labor history, Memphis and the Memphis police force has been an outlier in viciousness for a couple of generations. That's number one. Number two, in terms of history, the vision of America is these small New England farmers working away and making the country great. The richest city per capita in the United States in 1830 and 1840 wasn't New York. It was Natchez, Mississippi, on the Mississippi River, because it was a trading in cotton city, slaves and cotton. That's where the wealth came from. And I don't think most people would say, what are you talking about? Who ever heard of that place?
Okay, last question that I can fit with you, Wilmer Leon. Quickly, if you can, under a minute, what is the worst case scenario that we're looking at when it comes to police violence?
You just saw it. And unfortunately, it replicates itself time and time and time again. It's Rodney King. It's George Floyd. We just saw it.
Okay, we'll end it there. Wilmer Leon, thank you. Political scientist from Washington, D.C. Frank Imsbach, a pleasure. Workers Independent News from Madison, thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.